This interview is taking place with William Lucas on June 20th, 1994, and it's taking place at his home at 260 Prospect Street in Ishpeming. Let's start with getting your full name and the date and place of birth on tape.
Well, my full name is Bill Lucas. William, for short.
What's your middle name?
Sakri.
Can you spell that, please?
S-A-K-I-R-I. S-A-K-A-R-I, Sakri.
And
birth is January 5th, 1911.
Were you born at home or were you born in a hospital?
At home. At North Lake.
And can you give me your parents' first, middle, and last names? And if you know approximately when and where they were born?
My both parents were born in Finland. But father's name was William. He was Sakari Lucas too. The same name as I have. And mother's name was Ida. I don't know her second name. Yeah.
You don't know her middle name or her last name?
No.
Do you happen to know the name of the city in Finland where each of them was born?
Father was born in Simo, Finland. And mother was from Kemi.
Can you spell the names, please?
K-E-M-I, Kemi. And I don't know what year they were born.
Can you spell Simo for me?
Simo, or S-I-M-O.
Now, do you know approximately how old they were when they came to the United States?
They were both young. I think father was around 19, 20. Mother was about the same age. And they were married here in Ishpeming. Yeah.
Now, do you have any idea approximately when they would have come to the United States, and did they come directly to Ishpeming?
Father came first. He came with another fellow. They left Finland when Finland was occupied at that time by the Soviet Union. And the Tsar was recruiting Finnish boys into the Russian army because they had, they had some war going on somewhere in Russia. And they decided, well, they're not going to go in the Russian army. So they skipped into Sweden. And from Sweden to Norway, from Norway then they took a boat to Halifax. They landed in Canada someplace. And from Canada then to the Sioux, they came into Ishpeming. And by the way, before they came to Ishpeming, they went to Covington. The friend of my dad's, his sister was married to Huttula in Covington. He was the king of the Finns at that time. He was wealthy and he had over 100 men working all the time. So my dad's friend told my dad, he said, well, you might as well stay here. We got a steady job here. Well, dad got in the sawmill crew right away because he was... Technically, he was pretty handy, you know, in machinery and that. He picked that up because in his younger days, he had worked in big boats, you know, and he knew how to operate machinery and steam engines and that. So he operated the steam engine and the sawmill. And his partner, he was just doing every kind of work. And then they worked a week, and then my dad got paid. I can't remember, it was at 50 cents a day or something like that. And when he told his partner, he said, well, we got paid. Well, his partner said, I didn't get no pay. He said, no. He said, I want to ask my sister for my pay. She said, you already got paid. I gave you a shirt.
Wow.
That was his pay. So I'm not taking any more of this. I'm getting out of here. So my dad said, well, I'm coming with you. And at that time, my dad, he was on the sawmill. And a Canadian came there one day and wanted Dad to come to Canada with him. And he was opening up a huge sawmill in Canada. He wanted Dad to come over there and start in the beginning, you know, get things going. Dad said, no, I don't care to go out there. But Dad said, One thing I can all remember, he had a beautiful daughter. That end of that, they came to Ishming, he got a job in the mine. And then mother came to Ishming from the Navy.
Did they know each other before?
Yes.
They?
He wrote to her and gave her a ticket, and she came to Ishming then.
Now, I want to ask you a couple of questions about what you remember of growing up and what you saw about your dad, and not necessarily what he told you about you, what you saw, what you know of his work and what mines he worked in and for about how long that you might recall. Do you know which mines he worked in and approximately when that might have been?
Well, not my dad. Well, you can say he worked hard, but he played hard too. And he used to go out. He'd go out and get drunk on weekends. I can always remember that when I was a little kid. He'd come home raring drunk. But he never lost any time from work. He was known for good work at the mine. But then when he'd get home, he'd always abuse my wife, and I mean my mother, you know. He wasn't a very good father at home.
What mines? You wanted to know what mines he worked in.
Yeah, do you recall what mines he might have worked in? It's not terribly important.
He worked four different mines for CCI. He was a lead man in shaft work, you know, going down with the shaft right down.
Sinking shaft?
And he worked at Holmes Mine. And he worked at Lloyd Mine, and then number one, and then the Barnes and Hecker. He worked there, I don't know how many years. Then he worked last of all at the Inner Seal for at the Greenwood Mine.
Now, did you speak Finnish then when you were growing up at home?
Yes, all the time.
How old were you when you started to learn English?
Oh, we started quite young. I was interested in reading all the time. I know that was born into me. I could speak English very good. I think when I was about maybe second grade, first grade already, that's always my hobby. Right now and today, I'm reading all of them.
Did you grow up pretty much entirely in Ishpeming then?
Yes.
And you've always lived in Ishpeming? You've never really lived anyplace?
Well, I was born in North Lake. And about a year, I think it was about a year old when we moved to West Ishpeming. Right across the street from your grandma lived. In that double house?
Mm-hmm. That would have been on Marble Street,
yeah.
Then.
Mm-hmm.
But primarily it was the Ishpeming area. It wasn't Nagani or Republic or any place like that. That's basically what I was looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you go to school, and did you graduate from high school, and if so, when?
I went 10th grade. And it was in the spring of the year I took sick. They came down, me and a friend of mine, we both came down with yellow jaundice. We must have picked that up, something in the swamp water we were drinking, or we were out camping, you know. And I suffered then for a couple of months, and it was too late to go back to school anymore. And I figured, well, I'll continue in the fall, you know, where I left off. But my uncle came here from Chicago, and he talked me into coming to Chicago with him. So when they left here in the fall, I went with him.
Do you remember approximately what year that was?
Yes, in 28.
And then what did you do in Chicago, and how long did you live there?
I worked in Chicago for Western Electric Company. I worked there about 3 years.
And what was your job there?
I was what do you call, in assembly line, I was a chaser. That was nice. There was about 80 girls, and there was only four men there.
Somehow I take it you weren't chasing the girls, though. What exactly does
no,
a chaser?
I didn't chase the girls.
What does a chaser do?
A chaser, he had to keep the girls supplied. Every girl was on a machine, and that belt kept moving. And she always had to have her tools, or I mean her parts, with her. The little screws in a telephone, like the handset mounting there. There's about 70 pieces in that telephone. You wouldn't believe it. And each one does this little thing, and it keeps going. And my job was to see that they all had there was always material for every girl. And if I couldn't have it in the warehouse, I traced where they were making it. They made everything themselves. I'd run all over the plant, and I'd locate. I didn't have to do much searching after a while, because I knew exactly where to go. And I'd bring back the stuff in there. Then I left there in 30. They cut down on down to, was it, 3 days a week. Heck, I wasn't making enough to pay my board. So I said, when they come on a vacation, I just wrote them a letter, so I'm not coming back. I came out here and started work in the woods, and I made better money in the woods than I did down there.
Do you remember, this is back to the UP then?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Do you remember about how much money you could make in a week working in the woods?
In the woods? $1 a day. Sure.
And you did that for about how long?
We've done that for a couple of years anyway. Because dollar then was worth something. Because we could pick up our groceries. We picked up a whole armful for $1. Eggs were selling 10 cents a dozen. Imagine. And, boy, that was... And they weren't paying you anything for a pulp. There were pulp... Everybody was cutting pulp. Every farmer in an area was trying to raise money some way. And then you'd get maybe 2 cents a stick. Well, you had to cut an 8-foot stick. Say you got about 5 sticks off that one. Oh, that was 10 cents. Yeah.
Do you remember at that time other things that stand out in your mind about the differences in prices of things? Like, would you remember what you paid maybe for a pair of shoes or a pair of pants or something like that?
Yes. They were a lot cheaper. They were. It's hard to compare considering what they paid, now. Mm-hmm. But they were cheap. And you can say, like, when you could buy for $1, you could buy your week's groceries. You can't do it now.
No. All right, then, after you cut pulp, which you did for, did you say 3 years or so, or how long did you do that?
I cut it for a couple of years.
And then what after that?
When I was cutting the last... jobber I was cutting for was Kalle Hakkinen. He died now. And that was north of Ishming, behind Wipolas there. I cut for him all summer. And in the meantime, I applied for work at for the company, you know. And by geez, I got a card to go and get examined. So I told my boss, Kalle Hakkinen, I said, well, Kalle, I've got a job, I think anyway, for the company. He said, I'm sorry to see you go. He said, you're a good peacemaker. He said, I wouldn't go in a mine. He says, I ruined my health in the mine. I said, I'm going anyhow. So I did. Much to my surprise, during the World War II, who should come in the mine but the Kalle Hakkinen himself, and he was working for me.
That is a surprise.
He worked for me as a helper.
That's
right. Well, you call them big mitts, you know. And he just come in there, just work long enough so he gets Social Security. That's all he was interested in. He worked about it for 2 years. Sure.
You mentioned an interesting nickname, Big Mitts. Why did you call him Big Mitts?
Because he always wore, you know, the leather gloves, you know, without the fingers on them. Mm-hmm. You've seen them. What they call them now?
Mittens.
Mittens. Leather mittens. That's all. If we all use gloves, you know, it's easy to get a hold of everything. But him with his great big mitts.
Sure. I'm going to ask you to back up just a little bit and help me place a couple of the places that you talked about. Out north is a real common term to people in Ishpeming, but anybody who's not from Ishpeming wouldn't know where out north is. And behind Weepalas, which you and I know where it is, but anybody else wouldn't know. Could you establish it by the name of the county road or the names of the roads that are there today?
Behind Weepalas?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there's a road that goes behind Weepalas there. They call Wabash Creek. And the people go to the camp, they cross that little Wabash Creek. And that Wabash Creek originates behind Grandma's, right in Grandma's field, back in the middle of the swamp. That's where it originates. It goes down in there. But a lot of places it's underground. Yeah.
Would you happen to know the name of the county road that goes out there?
No, I don't. I've seen it, but I've...
573.
It's 573, the main road.
Okay, good.
But...
And then off of that, it's the North Camp Road.
North Camp Road,
okay,
and then the South
good.
Camp Road.
That's good. Okay, now, we're at... you got a card to get examined for the mine. Now, that's something new to me. What kind of a card was that? What you would apply, and then what did this card that you would get?
To get examined, every new employee, when they go to work for the company, you get a card, give you permission, or the doctor permission to examine, see that you're, you know, fit for the mine.
So that then would make the company pay for the exam?
Yeah, they paid that.
So that was what got you a pre-employment physical. Can you tell me when you started working for Cleveland Cliffs and in what mine?
I started for Cleveland Cliffs at the Cliff Shaft Mine. I worked on surface. And I worked there about 2 months, right up till almost... the end of shipping season, that was around November 30th. And then when I was through there, I got transferred over to Lloyd Mine. That's where I was then for quite a few years, 3 years there anyway. And then after I left Lloyd Mine, I come back to Cliff Shaft, where I spent 30 years at Cliff Shaft Mine. And when Cliff Shaft closed up, I ended up at Mather B. That was my limit. Yeah.
Okay, and you started at Cliff Shaft originally. When? Do you remember when?
I started originally on December 6th.
Of what year?
That was 35.
And you said you worked on surface for 2 months. Do you remember what your job consisted of during those 2 months?
At the... on lane, when I started on surface, it was lane solar plank outside. At that time, they used to unload the iron ore outside. And then instead of putting it on bare ground, we had long planks we had to put just like a sidewalk. And then we had to keep that thing spread out, you know, and make sure that there was always, you know, good, when the big shovel would come through, it could scoop up, instead of scooping up dirt, it'd be sliding on the, you know, cellar plank.
And that cellar plank, like, spelled like the cellar of a house?
Yeah.
Okay. Then you went to the Lloyd Mine that same year. Was that your first experience on the ground?
I was at the Lloyd before I went to Cliff Shafton, see?
So it was Cliffs and then Lloyd and then back to Cliffs. Okay.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the Lloyd Mine for just a little bit because that was part of your work life. About how long were you were at the Lloyd Mine? You said 3 years?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And do you happen to remember maybe the first day that you went underground at the Lloyd Mine? Do you remember what that was like?
I remember the first day. Did you know Tom Tippett?
A little bit, yeah. In fact, I don't. I don't know Tom. Go ahead.
He was captain at the mine. And him and I got along good because he was good friends with my dad. My dad worked for him, years and years before that, He remembered. And he done me a lot of favors, But that first day I started, I was putting on those electric haulage cars, that they have for hauling out iron ore, the big long trains, And there's always two brakies up sitting on the front, and the motorman is up in the other end, And then we're coming out of a crosscut, and we're going pretty good clip, And I jumped off the motor to throw a switch, so we'd go freewheeling down the line. And he happened to be standing there just about 10 feet away. He was waiting for us to go by. And he flagged the motorman down. Right away, he said, "Billy, don't you ever do that again." I was kind of confounded what he's saying. He said, "Don't you ever get off that motor till it stops." So from then on, I learned a lesson, He said, "It's got to come to a complete stop." Sure. But one thing I got to give him credit. If he gave you a heck, you had it coming. But he never carried a grudge. He never did carry a grudge. He'd forget about it, five minutes after,
So you consider him to be a pretty good boss?
Yeah, he was a pretty good boss, because I was there. I worked only about 2 weeks, and he called me in the office, and he told me, he said, "Billy, would you like to go mining?" I said, "I sure would." So I got mining.
Now, that seems to be a pretty big milestone from the guys that I've talked to when they had a chance to go off of their first job and to do mining. Can you tell me what was more attractive about doing the miner job than doing the brakeman's job?
There was more money in it. There was more money. And you were stationary. Like on a brakey job, you were just hauling that stuff out to shaft. And it was cold, riding in that draft. Oh, you had to have, you put your froze, And then you come back inside and load up again. And then that was the lowest pay there was breaking on a motor. That's where everybody got their start. Mm-hmm. But
do you remember what the pay was?
It was something around 68 cents an hour or something like that.
Now, when you were doing mining, can you describe, let me see how we want to do this. Can you describe how the day would start from the time you got to the mine and what you would kind of do in order,
yes,
including the clothes changes and all of that?
Oh, yes. Because all miners, they worked on two shifts, three shifts, some of them. And whenever your previous miners or gang finished up with, they made a report of that to the boss. So the oncoming boss always knew what was in your place before you got in there. If you needed lagging or you needed poles or if you needed a set of timber or anything like that, well, you'd make sure that you'd reported that to the guy that was hauling it in and make sure they'd haul it in. And you always, was prepared.
What is lagging?
Lagging is split cedar.
And
they use that for covering up the side walls of your drift. A drift is, you probably never heard the word drift.
Define
it's
it.
Like when they put a tunnel through, say a tunnel about this high, and not quite as high as this, but maybe 8 by 8. They keep going with that, blasting and drilling, and then moving the dirt out. Then they put a set of timber in there, big timber, up two on the side and one on top, And then they put poles and lagging on top of that, then, you know, so nothing will come through. So it makes everything safe for you working underneath. And the same thing on the side, they put lagging in there. Lagging come in, they take a log and split it in about 4, 7 foot long. And that was a good covering, you know. And poles, you needed them for on top. Lagging one on top of the poles. It's a kind of a...
So you're basically making a safe hallway to pass through to get to the new ore.
Yeah.
Can you describe for me... we're still talking about the Lloyd mine. Was the Lloyd mine hard ore or soft ore?
It's soft ore, yeah.
So it was kind of sticky and...
mud.
Can you describe for me... you would get down down the shaft and into the drift. Can you describe for me what it looked like? If someone had never been underground, what color, what did it smell like? Was it cold, hot, wet, dry?
Well, before I went to, I worked at Inland Steel, you know, before I went to any of the other mines. And my dad was working there at Inland Steel. So he got me a job there, and I was kind of nervous because I had never worked underground. It was just an open hole on surface and just a gate around, you know. And I got into the cage with all, there was about 10 men in the cage, and I plunked in there. We got down to the level. A level is where they level off and drift in, you know. The boss said, you take that motor and take it in the first cross cut and empty out them chutes. I had never been in underground in my life. I had never seen a motor, electric motor with the trolley pole on it and the trolley wire running, and where it was parked, you know, it was parked right over an open grizzly. A grizzly is a big pocket where they dump ore down, you know, and then from there it goes into a chute and into the cage. I was wondering, how in the heck will I know? From past experiences, I had been riding in Chicago on the streetcars, and I recognized the controls on that, Hollismore was the same as they had seen in Chicago, you know. There was the levers there, you know. So, and I knew it gets its power from the cable overhead. So, I put the trolley pole up on the trolley wire, and I put her in reverse, and I started moving. And I moved in way inside. I was going really slow. And I finally got in where the dirt was supposed to be hauled out. And there was the chute. It was just a big, big hole into the, you know, the roof lip. And there was just planks in front. And I looked up there, and there was chunks there as they were like bigger than this here.
Okay, just for the sake of the tape, can you tell me about the dimensions?
Yeah.
What the dimensions were?
They were, some of them were over 2 feet in diameter. And there was two planks there, and I tried. And the trolley wire ran right in front of the thing, you know. I looked, I said, holy geez. There was a bar, and they'd have to lift them planks up in order that dirt to slide off. Soon as I start prying, I'd miss a little bit, and I'd touch the trolley wire. Then 440 line, you know. Oh, that talk about your spark fly. I never tasted so much spark. I mean, copper that morning.
I'm going to have you stop there. This is tape number one, side number two, continuing with our interview with William Lucas and the story about the trolley wire and eating copper. Go ahead and continue.
Yes. And eventually the boss came around. I had three cars loaded. I said, holy Jesus, I'm going to get electrocuted here. And I said, there's one big chunk back there. I said, I can't get that out. And he said, well, he said, leave it there. He said, you come with me. So we came out of there and took another route and went inside. And he said, you know, I'll take you up to a certain contract, up on 100 foot, you know. I figured, where in the heck is that? You know. And we climbed. We went on a 100-foot climb up ladder road, a straight up. And you think that when you try and climb a ladder that's straight up for 100 feet, what that is. And we got up on top. I'll tell you, I was all out of wind, and he was out of wind, too. Mm-hmm. Then we walked from there. It was all open. Stoked out, you know, a big honeycomb place. And we walked for quite a ways, and there was a man, he was scraping dirt into the chute. So he said, Billy, he said, you stay here and help that guy, you know, scraping. So that's where I worked then the rest of the time that I worked. But it was gassy. Oh, every time you climbed that 100-foot raise, your head would just pound. It's the gas in there.
What kind of gas?
It was, well, from smoke. Mostly smoke. Mm-hmm. It was inadequate ventilation in there. There was a dead end in there, and they were going on three shifts. They were doing a lot of blasting on that, and the air was, they had fans on the level, but none up in the, where the men were working up there. It just circled around in there. And I'm glad that I got out of there. Because when I got hired there, Cap Crawford, he lived here in West Ishring. Cap Crawford said, Bill, he said, I'm going to hire you on for, there were six of us that got hired. You'll be hired temporarily. He said, when they get through with the shaft, he said, then you, I got to replace the shaft crew in, you know, inside. And you guys will be left out, and we'll call you when we need you. But I never did go back, although I did get a call to come back later on, just about a year later. But I didn't go back. I was working at Deloitte then. And I know I spent many a night sleeping out in a lawn there, especially working afternoon shift. It was that my head was just pounding. I thought it was split. Sure, it killed a lot of guys.
So there was, you didn't have any kind of breathing apparatus or anything like that?
No, they didn't have anything there, no.
When you say it killed a lot of guys, you mean it literally killed a lot of guys, or was it just that it was really hard on them?
Yeah. Well, it was, they all suffered from that. There's very few of them reached retirement age. Yeah.
And this was at the Lloyd mine?
This was at the Greenwood, you know.
Oh.
Yeah.
No, we didn't talk about the Greenwood mine at all. Where does that fit in? Is that before the Lloyd mine?
Before any of the others, you know.
About when was that?
That was in 35. Yeah.
And how long did you work at the Greenwood mine then?
I worked there maybe about 5 months. That's about all.
A couple of words I want to ask you about. Describe for me, paint me a picture, if you would, with words, of what it's like to be in a ladder road. What is it exactly? And I also want to know, when you're climbing 100 feet, were there any trapdoors in between as the safety mechanism?
That ladder road, it's wooden ladders. They were spaced, you know, just ordinary wooden ladders. And they're placed straight up, and that's the one you use to get up there. You have to climb those ladders, just like an ordinary ladder. Only they were made heavier.
And this was inside of basically a rocky tunnel that was just big enough for a guy to go up? Or how big around was the hole?
The ladder road itself was the miners that put them up there, about 4 feet square, about 4x4.
So, and were they lined with anything, or were they just open rock?
They were naked. They call them naked, you know. They're bare. Because that was a hard ore mine. Yeah.
So the Greenwood was hard ore?
Hard ore, yeah. They had hard ore and they had good ore. They would have stayed there longer, but they their reserve, what they had leased or owned, it petered out. They tried to, I think, purchase some from on the other side of their line, but whoever owned them would not sell. And yeah, and there's I must think about 300 men working there at the time. Sure.
Well, I've heard that one of the differences between working in a hard ore mine and a soft ore mine is the way that the ore would stick to the miner's clothes. Was there a difference that you perceived?
Well, it stuck more than in a soft ore because it's wet mud.
And what color is it?
Red.
So it was red,
and
just like the soft ore?
And hard ore, it's more bluish. Blue steel. And like in the hard ore mine at Cliff Shot, everything is, there's hardly any timber at all. Only place there's timber is in the chutes. And that's about all. And there's some on the catwalks, you know, and then on ladder roads and that. Everything is naked.
I want to ask you, backtrack and clarify one other thing that you said about the Lloyd mine. You said that the opening was a hole in the ground. Was there any kind of a structure over the cage and stuff? Was it all enclosed or was it exposed to the weather?
There was none. This was at the Greenwood now.
Oh, the Greenwood, okay.
Greenwood. There was just an open gate. I don't know if they put one in after I left from there, but there certainly wasn't any when I left there.
So the shaft then went down or went into the side of the hill? It went down?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And then there was some kind of a mechanism that would run the cage?
Oh, yeah. The hoist, the engine house was back about 100 feet. Then they had the ropes coming from the engine house up in the high trestle. And the trestle was right in line then with the shaft. So when the cage was coming up, the rope would go up the trestle through shib wheels and then down into the engine house. Yeah.
So then when the cage would ride up and down, was the cage enclosed on the top or was it open to the weather?
Well, it was open. Yeah.
So rain or shine, that was how they put the men up and down?
Mm-hmm. It was open.
All seasons of the year, winter and summer?
Yes.
The
same. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, I've got information from some people about the helmets and the lighting system and things. Could you describe the lighting system in the Greenwood mine?
Well, there was a light bulb strung maybe every 1,000 feet or so. And what do you call they tried to keep them there, but I don't know, they didn't hold up. They seemed to, you know, burn out in no time. Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of bulbs there that should have been replaced, but everybody depended just on a miner's lamp. And they had carbide lamps then. They didn't have the electric lamps. Electric lamps didn't come into use until 37, something like that.
Can you describe what a carbide lamp looked like and how it operated?
Well, it's in two pieces. It's the top piece is, it's got a big reflector there, and the bottom piece, you put the carbide in there, and then there's a little container on the side. You open that and pour a little water in there, and that makes a gas. You close the bottom, and then you just, on the side of the lamp, you can, there's a scratcher, and you scratch that, and it flares up, and it puts a flame out of about that long. Then before the day is over, your flame is going to keep getting shorter and shorter because the carbide is getting weak already down below.
Can you tell me in inches how big the flame was when it started and how big in inches when it went out?
Oh, the flame would run out about 5 inches.
Okay.
Yeah. And I know because when I started, even at the Lloyd bed, we had carbide lamps. And we're right in that first couple days, running out the shaft with the Hollis car, your light almost want to fade away, you know, the strong breeze, you know. Mm-hmm. So you had to turn your head away just so your light wouldn't go out. Mm-hmm. But imagine them guys worked in a mine before they had carbide lamps, they had candles just on their hat. And the little flame, no bigger than that there, illuminated the place.
No bigger than about 2 inches?
Yeah, about 2 inches. And no wonder there were so many accidents. They couldn't see what was overhead.
Mm-hmm. Did the carbide lamp have any particular odor?
Yes, it did, yeah.
Can you describe, is there anything that it's similar to?
No, it's an acid. And it's a strong odor, you know, carbide. Sulfur, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that combined with the odors of all the blasting
yes.
and the rest of it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that was it. You always had carried a can of carbide with you. Nice little flat container. And then a lighter and a scratcher. And there was all kinds of things. But it was mm-hmm. good that there wasn't anything better.
Mm-hmm.
And the reflector was about 4 inch. Oh, about, oh, maybe 3 inch in diameter, a copper reflector. And that would shine out, you know.
So, can you tell me about how many feet, if you were alone in a darkened area with just the carbide illumination, how big a circle of light would that carbide lamp give you to work in?
Oh, it'd give you, maybe 8-10 feet, something like that.
And then if it would burn for approximately how long?
It would burn pretty good for about 3-4 hours. Then you'd have to, shake it up or add a few carbide in there and then maybe a little water. Didn't need much water because the reservoir in there didn't hold no more than a couple of teaspoons, you know.
Yeah. Well, by the time your lamp would start to run out, how small a space would it light?
Well, it wouldn't light very much. You could just follow your footsteps, just barely. So you wouldn't step in any, dangerous place.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever in a place where your lamp went out and you were left in total
yes.
darkness? And then how difficult was it to relight?
In Cliff Shaft Mine even, I had my lamp go out. And I was in an area we didn't have the light bulbs in there at all. You just stayed put. You couldn't move. You didn't dare. It was pitch black. If you try, you're liable to fall down some hole.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's holes all around, you know, and then you didn't know what you're stepping into. I had that happen once. And I figured I'll just sit there because somebody will come along. But after that, even I, pretty every miner carried matches with them, and with a match you can at least see some distance before it blows out.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
What did that feel like when you were under there in total darkness and not knowing how long it would be till someone might come along?
It's scary, but you know that as long as I stay here, they're going to come through here. Somebody's going to come through here. And It's the only thing, it's pitch dark. So, and you won't want to be in there, too long.
Well, that brings me to another question I wanted to ask, and that is your experience with the carbide lamp going out was at Cliff's Shaft. What system was there at the Cliff Shaft, at the Lloyd, and the Greenwood for keeping track of who was underground and who had come up?
We all carried brass chicks with a hole in it, and you have a little clip, and you put it on your suspender, you know. And every time you went underground, it was issued to you in the dry, you know, where you change clothes. Mm-hmm. There was a board there. And you'd go and take your number or that. There was a man, the clerk, time clerk. He issued out the checks for every man who was going. And you always took your own check. And that way they checked who's going down. See, so there was no fooling around with that, you know. And every time when you come up, then you handed your check back to the, you know, check man. Mm-hmm. And usually our time clerk at the Cliff Shaft mine, he'd always be there in the morning when we're going down, and he would be there always at 3:30 when we come up. He'd make sure. And if there was one short, right away he would come down the dry and find out if so-and-so was out today, because his check wasn't turned in. Because they want to make sure nobody was left on the ground, see. Mm-hmm. So they were sticked on that.
Do you ever remember an incident where somebody was left underground and what happened then?
They were just left accidentally, you know. They were late in coming out. And they figured, well, he might find his way out, or he'll get... He had some problem or something. Mm-hmm. And then when he did come out, he was late, but he said that they had trouble, you know, with the electric wire, you know. They had to replace new wires, and they missed their cage, but then they took the other cage, you know. And they just called for the cage, and the guy in the engine house sent them the cage down, and they come up, you know.
How would they call for the cage?
Well, we had telephones at Shaft, and they had telephones at Lloyd Mine, and it was just a box, and then one mouthpiece there like the old time, and there's so many rings, you know, and so many rings for the engine house, and they could call different levels. And that's a limit of their telephone use. Even in Cliff Shaft, they had no communications with where the work is, way inside. Mm-hmm. No telephones. If a guy got hurt way inside, his partner would have to walk out, you know, or no, somebody would have to walk out and notify. Because the big mine as it was, they had one telephone at the shaft. There was nothing, transmitting service was poor. Like at the Madrid B, you could go on any contract and get in touch with the dispatcher. Right away there was a transmitter there. You could call them anytime. And they didn't have any, way of notifying.
What would you guess would be a typical walking distance or a typical walking time from the shaft to one of the typical working places? So if somebody was injured, were you talking maybe 10 minutes for somebody to walk back out and get help, or 20 minutes?
Yes.
Or how long?
Mm-hmm. Some of them working places, it took good 15 minutes to get up into place, you know. They'd walk on a level, then they'd take the ladder rolls up, and they have to wander, God, all over up in there, because on their Cliff Shaft, it's huge. Mm-hmm. Because imagine they they mined that for 100 years. And everything that came out, nothing was put in place. It's a huge aquifer right now, because it took 5 years for it to fill up.
With water.
Water, yeah.
Would you be willing to say, in the time that you worked in all the mines, and presumably it would be in one of the older mines, what kinds of injuries would there be in situations like that? And is there a worst one that you recall that you'd be willing to talk about? And if not, that's okay.
Well, we've had quite a few bad ones. But lots of them were broken legs. I've had a broken leg twice. And they both were freak accidents, too.
Let me have you go into that a little bit. Would you tell me how you broke your legs?
I was buying, have loose after a blast. I was barring up high. I had a long bar about 12 feet long. And I was prying that thing out, you know, and I finally got it loose. And it landed on a chunk that I got loose. And that chunk ricocheted and bounced over on my ankle. Imagine. Well, I said, of all the goofy things that happened. Sure.
Mm-hmm. And what mine would that have been in, and approximately when?
Was in at Cliff Shaftmine. I was off then, I think about 10 weeks, something like that.
And how did the other one happen?
The other one happened at Mother B. My partner and I were both drilling in the breast, and I was through drilling, and he was having trouble pulling his rod out from the breast. So I figured I'm going to give him a hand. So I walked over and I got in front of his machine and started pulling at the same time. And when we were pulling out, the breast caved in, you know, from on top. And chunks, one chunk no bigger than maybe a coffee pot.
Bones. So maybe like a foot by 6 inches.
Hanged up right on the high bone. That's all it took. All I heard, I felt a sting like a bee bite. I ignored it, you know. And then it was getting close to dinner time. I sat down and I tried to get up. I couldn't get up. It was hurting so bad. I said, uh-oh, there's something wrong. So I got all the dispatcher and the motor came in and gave me a ride to shaft. And that was home for another 12 weeks.
Oh.
Yeah.
I want to ask you to define a couple of terms for me. You talked about stoped out. What does stoped out mean?
Stope?
Stoped out.
Stoped out?
Stoped out. You said you had gone into, you'd go into some areas that were all stoped out.
They're all mined out. There's no ore left in there.
Okay, so it's like a big hole?
It's like a big hole, you know. Well, some of those stopes are real huge. Like Cliff Shaft, there's areas there they can put the Gossard building in them.
And so the Gossard building is a block by what, 8 or 10 stories?
Yes, they could put that Gossard in there. It wouldn't touch the sides. It's all honeycomb, seen pictures of the Mammoth Caves in Kentucky. Same thing. Great, big, big arches. You don't see the tops, you just see fog up there, that's all. Because they've been mined years and years ago. And it's just a lot of those places, the engineers say they did not mine Cliff Shaft out. They still made a profit the last year that they worked the mine, but they couldn't sell their ore anymore because everything was going pellet. They tried if they could make a pellet out of it, but they couldn't make it. They probably could nowadays. They have the method because they're mining Republic. And they can make pellets on a Republic ore. Well, they should make it on there, but it's... they pulled out, but they got the finest shaft there. The cage isn't there yet. They never did take it out. That's one of the kind in an American home of that type of cage. It's automatic. It's a Swedish make, and it's that skip. Oh, they're huge skips there. And
so you think that that is the cage at Cliff Shaft superior to the one at the Matter B, which was a newer mine?
Yeah.
Do you have any thought on why that type of cage would not have been used at the Matter B?
Well, I don't know why they did. They had their cage, and from what I hear, well, we used to pack down almost, what do they say, about 70 men at a time on a double deck.
70 per deck?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when they got orders to close the mine down, they capped it with cement, and they had pulled the cage right up underneath the cap. And when the cap was all done, they took a torch and they cut the cable, and the cage went down. Mm. They left it down there and went down there with a roar. Yeah.
You said it was an automatic cage. In what way was it automatic?
Everything was buttoned, just like in a hospital. You could call for it anytime. There was a big instrument board there, and all the levels and everything was on there, marked, and if the cage was available, and where it's at, and if it's on call, you had to wait till it's... whoever releases it, you know, call. And like if you went to shaft and you had to go up, well, you looked at the dial, see what bulbs are lit. So everything's okay, just press the button and the cage has come. When you get inside the cage, you close the door, and when you close the door, that made the final contact. Up you went. Silent, just like in a hospital. Yeah.
So just like an elevator.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Another term that I want you to define is the breast.
What?
The breast. You were talking about breast. Getting ore out of the breast, and the breast caved
in. Yeah, when you get up against a solid wall, the drill, that is your breast. Yeah.
So an undrilled face of rock,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah.
All right. Now, are there any other things about the Greenwood and the Lloyd mine that you think are noteworthy that you wanted to talk about?
Well, there isn't much I can remember anymore about the Greenwood mine. Some of them was, I was there such a short time. But the Lloyd, it was hot.
I know about how many degrees would hot be?
I'd say it was almost, a good 60 anyhow, 60, 70.
We're going to stop tape here and go to the second tape.